the necessary introduction.
Monsieur Poirot, Captain Black.
A few minutes' chat ensued, in the course of which Poirot elicited the fact that Captain Black was putting up at the Anchor Inn. The missing stick not having been discovered, which was not surprising, Poirot uttered more apologies, and we withdrew. We returned to the village at a great pace, and Poirot made a beeline for the Anchor Inn.
"Here we establish ourselves, eh, until our friend, the Captain, returns," he explained. "You noticed that I emphasized the point that we were returning to London by the first train? Possibly you thought I meant it. But no, you observed Mrs. Maltravers' face when she caught sight of this young Black, eh? She was clearly taken aback, and he..."
"Eh bien, he was very devoted. Did you not think so, eh?"
"And he was here on Tuesday night, the day before Mr. Maltravers died. We must investigate the doings of Captain Black, Hastings."
In about half an hour, we espied our quarry approaching the inn. Poirot went out and accosted him, and presently brought him up to the room we had engaged.
"I have been telling Captain Black of the mission which brings us here," he explained. "You can understand, Monsieur le Capitaine, that I am anxious to arrive at Mr. Maltravers' state of mind immediately before his death, and that at the same time I do not wish to distress Mrs. Maltravers unduly by asking her painful questions. Now, you were here just before the occurrence and can give us equally valuable information."
"Well, I'll do anything I can to help you, I'm sure," replied the young soldier. "But I'm afraid I didn't notice anything out of the ordinary. You see, although Maltravers was an old friend of my people's, I didn't know him very well myself."
"No, you came down when?"
"Tuesday afternoon. I went up to town early Wednesday morning, as my boat sailed from Tilbury about 12 o'clock. But some news I got made me alter my plans, as I dare say you heard me explain to Mrs. Maltravers."
"You were returning to East Africa, I understand."
"Yes. I've been out there ever since the war. A great country."
"Oh, exactly. Now, what was the talk about at dinner on Tuesday night, eh?"
"Oh, I don't know. The usual topics. Maltravers asked after my people, and then we discussed the question of German reparations, and then Mrs. Maltravers asked a lot of questions about East Africa, and I told them one or two yarns. That's about all, I think."
"Thank you."
Poirot was silent for a moment. Then he said gently, "With your permission, I should like to try a little experiment. You have told us all that your conscious self knows. I want now to question your subconscious self."
"Psychoanalysis, what?" said Black, with visible alarm.
"Oh, no," said Poirot reassuringly. "You see, it is like this. I give you a word, you answer with another, and so on. Any word, the first you think of. Shall we begin?"
"Well, all right,"
said Black slowly, but he looked uneasy.
"Note down the words, please, Hastings," said Poirot.
Then he took from his pocket his big turnip-faced watch and laid it on the table beside him.
"We will commence. Day."
There was a moment's pause, and then Black replied,
"Night."
As Poirot proceeded, his answers came quicker.
"Name?"
said Poirot.
"Place?"
"Bernard?"
"Shaw."
"Tuesday?"
"Dinner."
"Journey?"
"Ship."
"Country?"
"Uganda."
"Story?"
"Lions."
"Rook rifle?"
"Farm."
"Shot?"
"Suicide."
"Elephant?"
"Tusks."
"Money?"
"Lawyers."
"Thank you, Captain Black.
Perhaps you could spare me a few minutes in about half an hour's time?"
"Certainly."
The young soldier looked at him curiously and wiped his brow as he got up.
"And now, Hastings,"
said Poirot, smiling at me as the door closed behind him,
"you see it all, do you not?"
"I don't know what you mean."
"Does that list of words tell you nothing?"
I scrutinized it, but was forced to shake my head.
"Oh, I will assist you. To begin with, Black answered well within the normal time limit, eh? With no pauses, so we can take it that he himself has no guilty knowledge to conceal. Day to night and place to name are normal associations. I began work with Bernard, which might have suggested the local doctor had he come across him at all. Evidently, he had not. After our recent conversation, he gave dinner to my Tuesday. But journey and country were answered by ship and Uganda, showing clearly that it was his journey abroad that was important to him and not the one which brought him down here. Story recalls to him one of the lion stories he told at dinner. I proceeded to Rook Rifle, and he answered with a totally unexpected word, farm. When I say shot, he answers at once, suicide. The association seems clear. A man he knows committed suicide with a Rook Rifle on a farm somewhere. Remember, too, that his mind is still on the stories he told at dinner, and I think you will agree that I shall not be far from the truth if I recall Captain Black and ask him to repeat the particular suicide story which he told at the dinner table on Tuesday evening.
Black was straightforward enough over the matter.
But yes, I did tell them that story, now that I come to think of it. Chap shot himself on a farm out there, did it with a Rook Rifle through the roof of his mouth. Bullet lodged in the brain. Doctors were no end puzzled over it. There was nothing to show except a little blood on the lips. But what...
What has it got to do with Mr. Maltravers? You did not know, I see, that he was found with a Rook Rifle by his side?
What do you mean my story suggested to him?
Oh, but that's awful.
No, do not distress yourself. It would have been one way or another. Well, I must get on the telephone to London.
Poirot had a lengthy conversation over the wire and came back thoughtful. He went off by himself in the afternoon, and it was not till 7 o'clock that he announced that he could put it off no longer, but must break the news to the young widow. My sympathy had already gone out to her unreservedly. To be left penniless and with the knowledge that her husband had killed himself to assure her future was a hard burden for any woman to bear. I cherished a secret hope, however, that young Black might prove capable of consoling her after her first grief had passed. He evidently admired her enormously. Our interview with the lady was painful. She refused vehemently to believe the facts that Poirot advanced, and when she was at last convinced, broke down into bitter weeping. An examination of the body turned our suspicions into certainty. Poirot was very sorry for the poor lady, but after all, he was employed by the insurance company, and what could he do? As he was preparing to leave, he said gently to Mrs. Maltravers,
"Madame, you of all people should know that there are no dead."
Sorry, what do you mean?
She faltered, her eyes growing wide.
Have you never taken part in any spiritualistic seances, eh? You are mediumistic, you know.
Well, I have been told so. But you do not believe in spiritualism, surely?
Madame, I have seen some strange things. You know that they say in the village that this house is haunted?
She nodded. And at that moment, the parlourmaid announced that dinner was ready.
Won't you just stay and have something to eat?
We accepted gracefully, and I felt that our presence could not but help distract her a little from her own griefs. We had just finished our soup when there was a scream outside the door and the sound of breaking crockery. We jumped up. The parlourmaid appeared, her hand to her heart.
It was a man standing in the passage.
Poirot rushed out, returning quickly.
But there is no one there.
Isn't there, sir?
Said the parlourmaid weakly.
Oh, it did give me a start.
But why?
She dropped her voice to a whisper.
I thought it was the master. It looked like him.
I saw Mrs. Maltravers give a terrified start, and my mind flew to the old superstition that a suicide cannot rest. She thought of it too, I'm sure, for a minute later she caught Poirot's arm with a scream.
Didn't you hear that? Those three taps on the window. That's how he always used to tap when he passed round the house.
The ivy, I cried. It was the ivy against the pane.
But a sort of terror was gaining on us all. The parlourmaid was obviously unstrung, and when the meal was over, Mrs. Maltravers besought Poirot not to go at once. She was clearly terrified to be left alone. We sat in the little morning room. The wind was getting up and moaning round the house in an eerie fashion. Twice The door of the room came unlatched, and the door slowly opened, and each time she clung to me with a terrified gasp.
"Ah, but this door, it is bewitched," cried Poirot angrily at last.
He got up and shut it once more, then turned the key in the lock.
"I shall lock it so."
"No, don't do that," she gasped. "If it should come open now..."
And even as she spoke, the impossible happened. The locked door slowly swung open. I could not see into the passage from where I sat, but she and Poirot were facing it. She gave one long shriek as she turned to him.
"You saw him there in the passage?"
she cried. He was staring down at her with a puzzled face, then shook his head.
"I saw him! My husband! You must have seen him too!"
"Madame, I saw nothing. You are not well, unstrung."
"I am perfectly well. Oh, God!"
Suddenly, without warning, the lights quivered and went out. Out of the darkness came three loud raps. I could hear Mrs. Maltravers moaning. And then I saw. The man I had seen on the bed upstairs stood there facing us, gleaming with a faint, ghostly light. There was blood on his lips, and he held his right hand out, pointing. Suddenly, a brilliant light seemed to proceed from it. It passed over Poirot and me, and fell on Mrs. Maltravers. I saw her white, terrified face, and something else.
"My God, Poirot!" I cried. "Look at her hand, her right hand, it's all red!"
Her own eyes fell on it, and she collapsed in a heap on the floor.
"Blood!"
she cried hysterically.
"Yes, it's blood! I killed him! I did it! He was showing me, and then I put my hand on the trigger and pressed. Save me from him! Save me! He's coming back!"
Her voice died away in a gurgle.
"Lights," said Poirot briskly.
The lights went on as if by magic.
"That's it," he continued. "You heard those things? And you, Everett? By the way, this is Mr. Everett. Rather a fine member of the theatrical profession. I phoned to him this afternoon. His makeup is good, isn't it? Quite like the dead man. And with a pocket torch and the necessary phosphorescence, he made the proper impression. I shouldn't touch her right hand if I were you, Hastings. Red paint marks so. When the lights went out, I clasped her hand, you see. Oh, by the way, we mustn't miss our train. Inspector Japp is outside the window. A bad night, but he has been able to while away the time by tapping on the window every now and then. You see," continued Poirot, as we walked briskly through the wind and rain, "there was a little discrepancy. The doctor seemed to think the deceased was a Christian Scientist, eh? And who could have given him that impression but Mrs. Maltravers? But to us, she represented him as being in a great state of apprehension about his own health. Again, why was she so taken aback by the reappearance of young Black? And lastly, although I know that convention decrees that a woman must make a decent pretense of mourning for her husband, I do not care for such heavily rouged eyelids. You did not observe them, Hastings? No, as I always tell you, you see nothing. Well, there it was. There were the two possibilities. Did Black's story suggest an ingenious method of committing suicide to Mr. Maltravers, or did his other listener, the wife, see an equally ingenious method of committing murder? I inclined to the latter view. To shoot himself in the way indicated, he would probably have had to pull the trigger with his toe. Or at least so I imagine. Now, if Maltravers had been found with one boot off, we should almost certainly have heard of it from someone. An odd detail like that would have been remembered. No, as I say, I inclined to the view that it was a case of murder, not suicide. But I realized that I had not a shadow of proof in support of my theory. Hence the elaborate little comedy you saw played tonight."
"Yes, but even now I don't quite see all the details of the crime," I said.
"Well, let us start from the beginning. Here is a shrewd and scheming woman who, knowing of her husband's financial debacle, and tired of the elderly mate she has only married for his money, induces him to insure his life for a large sum, and then seeks for the means to accomplish her purpose. An accident gives her that, eh? The young soldier's strange story. The next afternoon, when Monsieur le Capitaine, as she thinks, is on the high seas, she and her husband are strolling round the grounds. "What a curious story that was last night," she observes. "Could a man shoot himself in such a way? Do show me if it is possible." The poor fool, he shows her. He places the end of his rifle in his mouth. She stoops down and puts her finger on the trigger, laughing up at him. "And now, sir," she says saucily, "supposing I pull the trigger?" And then, Hastings, she pulls it.
The Adventure of the Cheap Flat. So far, in the cases which I have recorded, Poirot's investigations have started from the central fact, whether murder or robbery, and have proceeded from thence by a process of logical deduction to the final triumphant unravelling. In the events I am now about to chronicle, a remarkable chain of circumstances led from the apparently trivial incidents which first attracted Poirot's attention to the sinister happenings which completed a most unusual case. I had been spending the evening with an old friend of mine, Gerald Parker. There had been perhaps about half a dozen people there besides my host and myself, and the talk fell, as it was bound to do sooner or later wherever Parker found himself, on the subject of house hunting in London. Houses and flats were Parker's special hobby. Since the end of the war, he had occupied at least half a dozen different flats and maisonettes. No sooner was he settled anywhere than he would light unexpectedly upon a new find, and would forthwith depart, bag and baggage. His moves were nearly always accomplished at a slight pecuniary gain, for he had a shrewd business head, but it was sheer love of the sport that actuated him, and not a desire to make money at it. We listened to Parker for some time with the respect of the novice for the expert. Then it was our turn, and a perfect babble of tongues was let loose. Finally, the floor was left to Mrs. Robinson, a charming little bride who was there with her husband. I'd never met them before, as Robinson was only a recent acquaintance of Parker's. "Talking of flats," she said, "have you heard of our piece of luck, Mr. Parker? We've got a flat, at last, in Montague Mansions."
"Oh, well," said Parker, "I've always said there are plenty of flats, at a price."
"Oh, yes, but this isn't at a price. It's dirt cheap. £80 a year."
But Montague Mansions is just off Knightsbridge, isn't it? Big, handsome building. Or are you talking of a poor relation of the same name stuck in the slums somewhere?"
"No, it's the Knightsbridge one, and that's what makes it so wonderful."
"Wonderful is the word. It's a blinking miracle. But there must be a catch somewhere. Big premium, I suppose."
"No premium."
"No premium? Oh, God, hold my head, somebody," groaned Parker.
"But we've got to buy the furniture," continued Mrs. Robinson.
"Ah," Parker bristled up, "I knew there was a catch."
"For £50, and it's beautifully furnished."
"Well, I give up," said Parker. "The present occupants must be lunatics with a taste for philanthropy."
Mrs. Robinson was looking a little troubled. A little pucker appeared between her dainty brows.
"It is queer, isn't it? You don't think that the place is haunted?"
"Well, I've never heard of a haunted flat," declared Parker decisively.
"No."
Mrs. Robinson appeared far from convinced.
"But there were several things about it that struck me as, well, queer."
"For instance," I suggested. "Ah," said Parker, "our criminal expert's attention is aroused.
Unburden yourself to him, Mrs. Robinson. Hastings is a great unraveller of mysteries.
I laughed, embarrassed, but not wholly displeased with the role thrust upon me.
Oh, well, not really queer, Captain Hastings, but when we went to the agents, Stosser and Paul, we hadn't tried them before because they only have the expensive Mayfair flats, but we thought at any rate, well, it would do no harm. But everything they offered us was £400 and £500 a year, or else huge premiums. And then, just as we were going, they mentioned that they had a flat at 80. But they doubted if it would be any good our going there, because it had been on their books some time, and they had sent so many people to see it that it was almost sure to be taken, well, snapped up, as the clerk put it. Only people were so tiresome in not letting them know. And then they went on sending, and, people get annoyed at being sent to a place that had perhaps been let some time.
Mrs. Robinson paused for some much-needed breath, and then continued.
We thanked him, and said that we quite understood it would probably be no good, but that we should like an order all the same, just in case. And we went there straight away in a taxi, for after all, you never know. Number 4 was on the second floor, and just as we were waiting for the lift, Elsie Ferguson, she's a friend of mine, Captain Hastings, and they're looking for a flat too, came hurrying down the stairs. "Ahead of you for once, my dear," she said. "But it's no good, it's already let." Well, that seemed to finish it, but, well, as John said, the place was very cheap. We could afford to give more, and perhaps if we offered a premium. A horrid thing to do, of course, and I feel quite ashamed of telling you, but you know what flat hunting is.
I assured her that I was well aware that in the struggle for house room the baser side of human nature frequently triumphed over the higher, and that the well-known rule of dog-eat-dog always applied.
So we went up, and would you believe it, the flat wasn't let at all. We were shown over it by the maid, and then we saw the mistress, and the thing was settled then and there. Immediate possession and £50 for the furniture. We signed the agreement next day, and we're to move in tomorrow.
Mrs. Robinson paused triumphantly.
And what about Mrs. Ferguson? Asked Parker. Let's have your deductions, Hastings.
Well, obvious, my dear Watson, I quoted lightly. She went to the wrong flat.
Oh, Captain Hastings, how clever of you!
Cried Mrs. Robinson admiringly. I rather wished Poirot had been there. Sometimes I have the feeling that he rather underestimates my capabilities. The whole thing was rather amusing, and I propounded the thing as a mock problem to Poirot on the following morning. He seemed interested and questioned me rather narrowly as to the rents of flats in various localities.
A curious story, he said thoughtfully. Excuse me, Hastings, I must take a short stroll.
When he returned about an hour later, his eyes were gleaming with a peculiar excitement. He laid his stick on the table and brushed the nap of his hat with his usual tender care before he spoke.
It is as well, mon ami, that we have no affairs of moment on hand. We can devote ourselves wholly to the present investigation.
Well, what investigation are you talking about?
The remarkable cheapness of your friend Mrs. Robinson's new flat.
Poirot, you're not serious.
Oh, I am most serious. Figure to yourself, my friend, that the real rent of those flats is £350. I have just ascertained that from the landlord's agents. And yet this particular flat is being sublet at £80. Why?
Well, there must be something wrong with it. Perhaps it's haunted, as Mrs. Robinson suggested.
Poirot shook his head in a dissatisfied manner.
Ah, then again, how curious it is that her friend tells her the flat is let, and when she goes up, behold, it is not so at all.
Yeah, but surely you agree with me that the other woman must have gone to the wrong flat. That's
the only possible solution. Ah, you may or may not be right on that point, Hastings. The fact still remains that numerous other applicants were sent to see it, and yet, in spite of its remarkable cheapness, it was still in the market when Mrs. Robinson arrived.
Well, that shows that there must be something wrong about it.
Mrs. Robinson did not seem to notice anything amiss. Very curious, is it not? Did she impress you as being a truthful woman, Hastings?
Oh, she was a delightful creature.
Oh, évidemment. Since she renders you incapable of replying to my question, describe her to me, then.
Well, she's tall and fair. Her hair's really a beautiful shade of auburn.
Ah, always you have had a penchant for auburn hair, eh? Murmured Poirot. But, continue.
Well, blue eyes and a very nice complexion, and, well, that's all, I think, I concluded lamely.
And her husband?
Oh, well, he's quite a nice fellow, nothing startling.
Dark or fair?
Ah, well, I don't know. Betwixt and between, and, well, just an ordinary sort of face. Poirot nodded.
Yes, there are hundreds of these average men.
And anyway, you bring more sympathy and appreciation to your description of women.
Do you know anything about these people? And does Parker know them well?
Well, they're just recent acquaintances, I believe, but surely, Poirot, you don't think for an instant that...
Poirot raised his hand.
Tout doucement, mon ami. Have I said that I think anything? All I say is, it is a curious story. And there is nothing to throw light upon it, except perhaps the lady's name. Eh, Hastings?
Her name is Stella, I said stiffly. But I don't see that... Poirot interrupted me with a tremendous chuckle. Something seemed to be amusing him vastly.
And Stella means a star, does it not? Famous. But what on earth? And stars give light? Voilà. Now, calm yourself, Hastings. Do not put on that air of injured dignity. Come, we will go to Montague Mansions and make a few inquiries.
I accompanied him, nothing loath. The mansions were a handsome block of buildings in excellent repair. A uniformed porter was sunning himself on the threshold, and it was to him that Poirot addressed himself.
Oh, pardon, but could you tell me if a Mr. and Mrs. Robinson reside here?
The porter was a man of few words and apparently of a sour or suspicious disposition. He hardly looked at us and grunted out,
Number 4, second floor.
Oh, thank you. Can you tell me how long they have been here?
6 months.
I started forward in amazement, conscious, as I did so, of Poirot's malicious grin. Impossible! I cried. You must be making a mistake.
6 months.
But are you sure? The lady, I mean, is tall and fair, with reddish gold hair, and...
That's her, said the porter. Come in the Michaelmas quarter, they did, just 6 months ago.
He appeared to lose interest in us and retreated slowly up the hall. I followed Poirot outside.
Eh bien, Hastings?
My friend demanded slyly.
Are you so sure now that delightful women always speak the truth?
I did not reply. Poirot had steered his way into Brompton Road before I asked him what he was going to do and where we were going.
To the house agents, Hastings. I have a great desire to have a flat in Montague Mansions. If I am not mistaken, several interesting things will take place there before long.
We were fortunate in our quest. Number 8, on the 4th floor, was to be let furnished at 10 guineas a week. Poirot promptly took it for a month. Outside in the street again, he silenced my protests.
Oh, but I make money nowadays, huh? Why should I not indulge a whim? By the way, Hastings, have you a revolver?
Yes, somewhere, I answered, slightly thrilled. Do you think...
That you will need it? No, it is quite possible. Oh, the idea pleases you, I see. Always the spectacular and romantic appeals to you.
The following day saw us installed in our temporary home. The flat was pleasantly furnished. It occupied the same position in the building as that of the Robinsons, but was 2 floors higher. The day after our installation was a Sunday. In the afternoon, Poirot left the front door ajar and summoned me hastily as a bang reverberated from somewhere below.
Now look over the banisters, eh? Are those your friends? Do not let them see you.
I craned my neck over the staircase. That's them, I declared, in an ungrammatical whisper.
Good. Wait a while.
About half an hour later, a young woman emerged in brilliant and varied clothing. With a sigh of satisfaction, Poirot tiptoed back into the flat.
C'est ça? After the master and mistress? The maid? The flat should now be empty.
But what are we going to do?
I asked uneasily. Poirot had trotted briskly into the scullery and was hauling at the rope of the coal lift.
We are about to descend after the method of the dustbins,
he explained cheerfully.
No one will observe us. The Sunday concert, the Sunday afternoon out, and finally the Sunday nap after the Sunday dinner of England, the roast beef. All these will distract attention from the doings of Hercule Poirot. Come, my friend.
He stepped into the rough wooden contrivance, and I followed him gingerly.
Are we going to break into the flat?
I asked dubiously. Poirot's answer was not too reassuring.
Well, not precisely today, he replied.
Pulling on the rope, we descended slowly till we reached the second floor. Poirot uttered an exclamation of satisfaction as he perceived that the wooden door into the scullery was open.
Oh, you observe, never do they bolt these doors in the daytime, and yet anyone could mount or descend as we have done. At night, yes, though not always then. And it is against that we are going to make provision.
He had drawn some tools from his pocket as he spoke, and at once set deftly to work, his object being to arrange the bolt so that it could be pulled back from the lift. The operation only occupied about 3 minutes, then Poirot returned the tools to his pocket, and we reascended once more to our own domain. On Monday, Poirot was out all day, but when he returned in the evening, he flung himself into his chair with a sigh of satisfaction.
Oh, Hastings, shall I recount to you a little history? A story after your own heart which will remind you of your favourite cinema?
Oh, go ahead, I laughed. I presume that it's a true story, not one of your efforts of fancy.
Oh, no, it is true enough. Inspector Japp of Scotland Yard will vouch for its accuracy, since it was through his kind offices that it came to my ears. Now listen, Hastings. A little over 6 months ago, some important naval plans were stolen from an American government department. They showed the position of some of the most important harbour defences, and would be worth a considerable sum to any foreign government, that of Japan, for example. Now, suspicion fell upon a young man named Luigi Valdarno, an Italian by birth who was employed in a minor capacity in the department and who was missing at the same time as the papers. Whether Luigi Valdarno was a thief or not, he was found 2 days later on the east side in New York, shot dead, and the papers were not on him. Now, for some time past, Luigi Valdarno had been going about with a Miss Elsa Hart, a young concert singer who had recently appeared and who lived with a brother in an apartment in Washington. Nothing was known of the antecedents of Miss Elsa Hart, and she disappeared suddenly about the time of Valdarno's death. Now, there are reasons for believing that she was in reality an accomplished international spy who has done much nefarious work under various aliases. The American Secret Service, while doing their best to trace her, also kept an eye upon certain insignificant Japanese gentlemen living in Washington. They felt pretty certain that when Elsa Hart had covered her tracks sufficiently, she would approach the gentleman in question. One of them left suddenly for England a fortnight ago. On the face of it, therefore, it would seem that Elsa Hart is in England.
Poirot paused and then added softly,
the official description of Elsa Hart is height 5 feet 7 inches, eyes blue, hair auburn, fair complexion, nose straight, no special distinguishing marks. Mrs. Robinson, I gasped. Well, there is a chance of it anyhow, amended Poirot. Also, I learn that a swarthy man, a foreigner of some kind, was inquiring about the occupants of number 4 only this morning. Therefore, mon ami, I fear that you must forswear your beauty sleep tonight and join me in my all-night vigil in that flat below, armed with that excellent revolver of yours. Bien entendu?
Right! I cried with enthusiasm. When shall we start?
The hour of midnight is both solemn and suitable, I fancy. Nothing is likely to occur before then.
At 12 o'clock precisely, we crept cautiously into the coal lift and lowered ourselves to the second floor. Under Poirot's manipulation, the wooden door quickly swung inwards and we climbed into the flat. From the scullery, we passed into the kitchen where we established ourselves comfortably in two chairs, with the door into the hall ajar.
"Now we have but to wait," said Poirot contentedly, closing his eyes.
To me, the waiting appeared endless. I was terrified of going to sleep, and just when it seemed to me that I'd been there about 8 hours, and had, as I found out afterwards, in reality been exactly 1 hour and 20 minutes, a faint scratching sound came to my ears. Poirot's hand touched mine. I rose, and together we moved carefully in the direction of the hall. The noise came from there. Poirot placed his lips to my ear.
"Outside the front door. They are cutting out a lock. When I give the word, not before, fall upon him from behind and hold him fast. Now be careful. He will have a knife."
Presently, there was a rending sound and a little circle of light appeared through the door. It was extinguished immediately and then the door was slowly opened. Poirot and I flattened ourselves against the wall. I heard a man's breathing as he passed us. Then he flashed on his torch, and as he did so, Poirot hissed in my ear,
"Allez!"
We sprang together. Poirot, with a quick movement, enveloped the intruder's head with a light woolen scarf whilst I pinioned his arms. The whole affair was quick and noiseless. I twisted a dagger from his hand, and as Poirot brought down the scarf from his eyes, whilst keeping it wound tightly round his mouth, I jerked up my revolver where he could see it and understand that resistance was useless. As he ceased to struggle, Poirot put his mouth close to his ear and began to whisper rapidly. After a minute, the man nodded. Then, enjoining silence with a movement of the hand, Poirot led the way out of the flat and down the stairs. Our captive followed, and I brought up the rear with the revolver. When we were out in the street, Poirot turned to me.
"There's a taxi waiting just around the corner. Give me the revolver. We shall not need it now."
"But look, if this fellow tries to escape..."
Poirot smiled. "He will not." I returned in a minute with the waiting taxi. The scarf had been unwound from the stranger's face, and I gave a start of surprise.
"But he's not a Jap,"
I ejaculated in a whisper to Poirot.
"Observation was always your strong point, Hastings. Nothing escapes you. No, the man is not a Jap. He is an Italian."
We got into the taxi and Poirot gave the driver an address in St. John's Wood. I was by now completely fogged. I didn't like to ask Poirot where we were going in front of our captive and strove in vain to obtain some light upon the proceedings. We alighted at the door of a small house standing back from the road. A returning wayfarer, slightly drunk, was lurching along the pavement and almost collided with Poirot, who said something sharply to him, which I did not catch. All three of us went up the steps of the house. Poirot rang the bell and motioned us to stand a little aside. There was no answer, and he rang again, and then seized the knocker, which he plied for some minutes vigorously. A light appeared suddenly above the fanlight, and the door opened cautiously a little way.
"What the devil do you want?" a man's voice demanded harshly. "I want a doctor. My wife is taken ill." "Well, there's no doctor here."
The man prepared to shut the door, but Poirot thrust his foot in adroitly. He became suddenly a perfect caricature of an infuriated Frenchman.
"What do you say there is no doctor, eh? I will have the law of you. You must come. I will stay here and ring and knock all night."
"My dear sir..." The door was opened again. The man, clad in a dressing gown and slippers, stepped forward to pacify Poirot with an uneasy glance around.
"I will call the police."
Poirot prepared to descend the steps.
No. Don't do that, for heaven's sake."
The man dashed after him. With a neat push, Poirot sent him staggering down the steps. In another minute, all three of us were inside the door, and it was pushed to and bolted.
"Quick, in here!"
Poirot led the way into the nearest room, switching on the light as he did so.
And you, behind the curtain.
Si, signor,
said the Italian, and slid rapidly behind the full folds of rose-coloured velvet which draped the embrasure of the window. Not a minute too soon. Just as he disappeared from view, a woman rushed into the room. She was tall, with reddish hair, and held a scarlet kimono round her slender form.
"Where's my husband?"
she cried with a quick, frightened glance.
"Who are you?"
Poirot stepped forward with a bow.
"It is to be hoped that your husband will not suffer from a chill. I observed that he had slippers on his feet and that his dressing gown was a warm one."
"Who are you, and what are you doing in my house?"
"It is true that none of us had the pleasure of your acquaintance, madame. It is especially to be regretted, as one of our number has come specially from New York in order to meet you."
The curtains parted, and the Italian stepped out. To my horror, I observed that he was brandishing my revolver, which Poirot must doubtless have put down inadvertently in the cab. The woman gave a piercing scream and turned to fly, but Poirot was standing in front of the closed door.
"Let me by!" she shrieked. "He'll murder me!"
"Who was it that croaked Luigi Valdano?"
asked the Italian hoarsely, brandishing the weapon and sweeping each one of us with it. We dared not move.
"My God, Poirot, this is awful. What shall we do?" I cried.
"You will oblige me by refraining from talking so much, Hastings. I can assure you that our friend will not shoot until I give the word."
"You sure of that, huh?"
said the Italian, leering unpleasantly. It was more than I was, but the woman turned to Poirot like a flash.
"What is it you want?"
Poirot bowed.
"I do not think it is necessary to insult Miss Elsa Hart's intelligence by telling her."
With a swift movement, the woman snatched up a big black velvet cat, which served as a cover for the telephone. "They're stitched in the lining of that."
"Ah, clever," murmured Poirot appreciatively.
He stood aside from the door.
"Good evening, madame. I will detain your friend from New York whilst you make your getaway."
"What a fool!"
roared the big Italian, and raising the revolver, he fired point blank at the woman's retreating figure, just as I flung myself upon him. But the weapon merely clicked harmlessly, and Poirot's voice rose in mild reproof.
"Never will you trust your old friend, Hastings, eh? I do not care for my friends to carry loaded pistols about with them, and never would I permit a mere acquaintance to do so. No, no, mon ami."
This to the Italian, who was swearing hoarsely. Poirot continued to address him in a tone of mild reproof.
"See now what I have done for you. I have saved you from being hanged. And do not think that our beautiful lady will escape. No, no, the house is watched, back and front. Straight into the arms of the police they will go. Is not that a beautiful and consoling thought? Oh, yes, you may leave the room now, but be careful, be very careful. He is gone. And my friend Hastings looks at me with eyes of reproach. But it's all so simple. It was clear from the first that out of several hundred, probably, applicants for number 4 Montague Mansions, only the Robinsons were considered suitable. Why? What was there that singled them out from the rest? At practically a glance? Their appearance? Possibly, but it was not so unusual. Their name, then?"
"Yes, but there's nothing unusual about the name of Robinson," I cried. "It's quite a common name."
"Ah, sapristi, but exactly. That was the point. Elsa Hart and her husband, or brother, or whatever he really is, come from New York, and take a flat in the name of Mr. and Mrs. Robinson. Suddenly, they learn that one of these secret societies, the Mafia or the Camorra, to which doubtless Luigi Valdano belonged, is on their track. So what did they do? They hit on a scheme of transparent simplicity. Evidently, they knew that their pursuers were not personally acquainted with either of them. What then can be simpler? They offer the flat at an absurdly low rental. Of the thousands of young couples in London looking for flats, they cannot fail to be several Robinsons. It is only a matter of waiting. If you will look at the name of Robinson in the telephone directory. You will realize that a fair-haired Mrs. Robinson was pretty sure to come along sooner or later, and then what will happen? The Avenger arrives. He knows the name. He knows the address. He strikes. All is over. Vengeance is satisfied. And Miss Elsa Hart has escaped by the skin of her teeth once more.
Oh, by the way, Hastings, you must present me to the real Mrs. Robinson, that delightful and truthful creature. What will they think when they find their flat has been broken into? We must hurry back. Ah, that sounds like the good Inspector Japp and his friends arriving.
A mighty tattoo sounded on the knocker. Look, how do you know this address? I asked as I followed Poirot out into the hall. Oh, of course, you had the first Mrs. Robinson followed when she left the other flat.
A la bonne heure, Hastings. You use your grey cells at last. Now for a little surprise for Japp.
Softly unbolting the door, he stuck the cat's head round the edge and ejaculated a piercing meow. The Scotland Yard inspector, who was standing outside with another man, jumped in spite of himself.
Oh, it's only Monsieur Poirot at one of his little jokes, he exclaimed as Poirot's head followed that of the cat. Let us in, monsieur.
You have our friends safe and sound?
Oh, yes, we've got the birds all right, but they hadn't got the goods with them.
Ah, I see, so you came to search. Well, I am about to depart with Hastings, but I should like to give you a little lecture upon the history and habits of the domestic cat.
Oh, good, for the Lord's sake, have you gone completely balmy?
The cat, declaimed Poirot, was worshipped by the ancient Egyptians. It is still regarded as a symbol of good luck if a black cat crosses your path. Ah, this cat crossed your path tonight, Japp. To speak of the interior of any animal or any person is not, I know, considered polite in England. But the interior of this cat is perfectly delicate. I refer to the lining.
With a sudden grunt, the second man seized the cat from Poirot's hand.
Oh, I forgot to introduce you, said Japp. Mr. Poirot? This is Mr. Burt of the United States Secret Service.
The American's trained fingers had felt what he was looking for. He held out his hand, and for a moment speech failed him. Then he rose to the occasion.
Pleased to meet you, said Mr. Burt.
The Mystery of Hunter's Lodge.
After all,
murmured Poirot,
it is possible that I shall not die this time.
Coming from a convalescent influenza patient, I hailed the remark as showing a beneficial optimism. I myself had been the first sufferer from the disease. Poirot, in his turn, had gone down. He was now sitting up in bed, propped up with pillows, his head muffled in a woolen shawl, and was slowly sipping a particularly noxious tisane, which I had prepared according to his directions. His eye rested with pleasure upon a neatly graduated row of medicine bottles which adorned the mantelpiece.
Oh, yes, yes,
my little friend continued.
Once more shall I be myself again, eh? The great Hercule Poirot, the terror of evildoers. Yeah, figure to yourself, mon ami, that I have a little paragraph to myself in society gossip, eh? Oh, but yes, here it is. Go it, criminals, all out. Hercule Poirot. And believe me, girls, he is some Hercules. Our own pet society detective can't get a grip on you. Cause why? Cause he's got la grippe himself?
I laughed. Good for you, Poirot. You're becoming quite a public character, and fortunately, you haven't missed anything of particular interest during this time.
That is true. The few cases I have had to decline did not fill me with any regret.
Our landlady stuck her head in at the door.
There's a gentleman downstairs. Says he must see Monsieur Poirot or you, Captain. And seeing as he was in a great to-do, and with all that quite the gentleman, I brought up his card.
She handed me a bit of pasteboard. Mr. Roger Havering, I read. Poirot motioned with his head towards the bookcase, and I obediently pulled forth Who's Who. Poirot took it from me and scanned the pages rapidly.
Oh,
second son of 5th Baron Windsor, eh? Married 1913, Zoe, the fourth daughter of William Crabbe.
Hmm, I said. I rather fancy that's the girl who used to act at the Frivolity. Only she called herself Zoe Carisbrook. I remember she married some young man about town, yeah, just before the war.
Would it interest you, Hastings, to go down and hear what our visitor's particular little trouble is? Make him all my excuses.
Roger Havering was a man of about 40, well set up and of smart appearance. His face, however, was haggard, and he was evidently labouring under great agitation. Captain Hastings, you are Monsieur Poirot's partner, I understand. It's imperative that he should come with me to Derbyshire today.
Well, I'm afraid that's impossible, I replied. Poirot is ill in bed, influenza.
His face fell.
Oh, dear me, that's a great blow to me.
Well, the matter on which you want to consult him is serious?
Oh, my God, yes. My uncle, the best friend I have in the world, was foully murdered last night.
What, here in London?
No, in Derbyshire. I was in town and received a telegram from my wife this morning. Immediately upon its receipt, I determined to come round and beg Monsieur Poirot to undertake the case.
Well, if you will excuse me a minute, I said, struck by a sudden idea. I rushed upstairs and in a few brief words acquainted Poirot with the situation. He took any further words out of my mouth.
I see, I see. You want to go yourself, is it not so? Well, why not? You should know my methods by now. All I ask is that you should report to me fully every day and follow implicitly any instructions I may wire you.
To this, I willingly agreed. An hour later, I was sitting opposite Mr. Havering in a first-class carriage on the Midland Railway, speeding rapidly away from London. To begin with, Captain Hastings, you must understand that Hunter's Lodge, where we're going, and where the tragedy took place, is only a small shooting box in the heart of the Derbyshire Moors. Our real home is near Newmarket, and we usually rent a flat in town for the season. Hunter's Lodge is looked after by a housekeeper who is quite capable of doing all we need when we run down for an occasional weekend. Of course, during the shooting season, we take down some of our own servants from Newmarket. My uncle, Mr. Harrington Pace, as you may know, my mother was a Miss Pace of New York, has, for the last 3 years, made his home with us. He never got on well with my father or my elder brother, and I suspect that my being somewhat of a prodigal son myself rather increased than diminished his affection towards me. Of course, I am a poor man, and my uncle was a rich one, in other words. Well, he paid the piper. But though exacting in many ways, he wasn't really hard to get on with, and we all three lived very harmoniously together. But 2 days ago, my uncle, rather wearied with some recent gaieties of ours in town, suggested that we should run down to Derbyshire for a day or two. My wife telegraphed to Mrs. Middleton, the housekeeper, and we went down that same afternoon. Yesterday evening I was forced to return to town, but my wife and my uncle remained on. This morning I received this telegram. He handed it over to me. Come at once. Uncle Harrington murdered last night. Bring good detective if you can, but do come. Zoe.
Then, as yet, you know no details?
No, I suppose it'll be in the evening papers. Without doubt, the police are in charge. It was about 3 o'clock when we arrived at the little station of Elmersdale. From there, a 5-mile drive brought us to a small grey stone building in the midst of the rugged moors.
A lonely place,
I observed with a shiver. Havering nodded.
Oh, I shall try to get rid of it. I could never live here again.
We unlatched the gate and were walking up the narrow path to the oak door when a familiar figure emerged and came to meet us.
Jap!
I ejaculated. The Scotland Yard inspector grinned at me in a friendly fashion before addressing my companion.
Mr. Havering, I think? I've been sent down from London to take charge of this case, and I'd like a word with you, if I may, sir.
My wife and I've seen your good lady, sir. And the housekeeper. And I won't keep you a moment, but I'm anxious to get back to the village, now that I've seen all there is to see here.
Well, I know nothing as yet as to what...
Exactly, said Jap soothingly. But there are just one or two little points I'd like your opinion about, all the same.
Our Captain Hastings here, he knows me, and he'll go on up to the house and tell them you're coming. Now, what have you done with the little man, by the way, Captain Hastings?
He's ill in bed with influenza.
Oh, is he now? I'm sorry to hear that. Rather the case of the cart without the horse, you being here without him, isn't it?
And on his rather ill-timed jest, I went on to the house. I rang the bell as Jap had closed the door behind him. After some moments, it was opened to me by a middle-aged woman in black.
Mr. Havering will be here in a moment, I explained. He's been detained by the inspector. I've come down with him from London to look into the case. Now, perhaps you can tell me briefly what occurred last night.
Come inside, sir. She closed the door behind me, and we stood in the dimly lighted hall.
It was after dinner last night, sir, that the man came. He asked to see Mr. Pace, sir, and seeing that he spoke the same way, I thought it was an American gentleman friend of Mr. Pace's, and I showed him into the gunroom, and then went to tell Mr. Pace. He wouldn't give any name, which, of course, was a bit odd, now I come to think of it. I told Mr. Pace, and he seemed puzzled, like, but he said to the mistress, "Excuse me, Zoe, while I see what this fellow wants." He went off to the gunroom, and I went back to the kitchen, but after a while I heard loud voices as if they were quarrelling, and I came out into the hall. At the same time, the mistress, she comes out too, and just then there was a shot, and then a dreadful silence. We both ran to the gunroom door, but it was locked, and we had to go round to the window. It was open, and there inside was Mr. Pace, all shot and bleeding.
And what became of the man?
Well, he must have got away through the window, sir, before we got to it.
And then?
Well, Mrs. Havering sent me to fetch the police. And 5 miles to walk it was. They came back with me, and the constable, well, he stayed all night, and this morning the police gentleman from London arrived.
And what was this man like who called to see Mr. Pace? The housekeeper reflected.
Well, he had a black beard, sir, and was about middle-aged, and had on a light overcoat. Beyond the fact that he spoke like an American, I didn't notice much about him.
I see. Now, I wonder if I can see Mrs. Havering.
Oh, she's upstairs, sir. Shall I tell her?
Oh, if you please. Tell her that Mr. Havering is outside with Inspector Japp and that the gentleman he has brought back with him from London is anxious to speak to her as soon as possible.
Very good, sir.
I was in a fever of impatience to get all the facts. Japp had got 2 or 3 hours' start on me, and his anxiety to be gone made me keen to be close at his heels. Mrs. Havering did not keep me waiting long. In a few minutes I heard a light step descending the stairs and looked up to see a very handsome young woman coming towards me. She wore a flame-coloured jumper that set off the slender boyishness of her figure. On her dark head was a little hat of flame-coloured leather. Even the present tragedy could not dim the vitality of her personality. I introduced myself and she nodded in quick comprehension.
"Oh, of course, I've often heard of you and your colleague. Monsieur Poirot, you've done some wonderful things together, haven't you? It was very clever of my husband to get you so promptly. Now, will you ask me questions? I mean, that's the easiest way, isn't it, of getting to know all you want to about this dreadful affair?"
"Well, thank you, Mrs. Havering. Now, what time was it that this man arrived?"
It must have been just before 9 o'clock. We'd finished dinner, and we were sitting over our coffee and cigarettes.
"Now, your husband had already left for London?"
"Yes, he went up by the 6:15.
"Did he go by car to the station, or did he walk?"
"Our own car isn't down here. One came out from the garage in Elmersdale to fetch him in time for the train."
"Was Mr. Pace quite his usual self?"
"Oh, absolutely. Most normal in every way."
"Now, can you describe this visitor at all?"
"Oh, no, I'm afraid..."